Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do they really know? Every week, me, Jason Carty,
and me, Stephen Cockcroft, the Beatle Brains of Ireland, go here, there and everywhere, taking a forensic deep dive into the story of the greatest band of all time, the Beatles.
Come with us every week on a magical mystery tour as we talk albums, singles, solo careers, books, films, and so much more.
Become a member of Nothing Is Real on Acast Plus today for ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more, because happiness is a warm podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do you really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin, and the Queen says no to pot-smoking FBI members. We are going to talk today about something at the very end of the Beatles' existence, namely January the 3rd, 1970. On the first weekend of the new year of the new decade, Paul, George and Ringo went into Abbey Road Studio 2, and with George Martin behind the production desk, they cut a new Beatles song, I Me Mine, the last one. And then the following day, they finished off the Let It Be song, and then they were done. And this session always looked like an outlier. It had been 4 months since all four of them had been in a recording studio together when they finished up Abbey Road the previous August. So in this podcast, we're going to look at the timeline of events between August 69 and January 1970 and ask, you know, were the Beatles really finished? This session as an outlier, could it have pointed a direction for them continuing on in the 1970s? I have to admit, you know, when I first heard about this session, it always looked like an odd one out, this January 1970 session.
Yes. As you say, it had been several months since they'd been in the studio. Really, this was dictated by the fact that the release date was looming for the film, Let It Be. The song, I Me Mine, appears in the film. And so they needed a studio run through that they could add to the soundtrack. So they were. It was really a session that was forced on them by the release date of the film.
Yes, and there's certain stories and narratives that go around the Beatles, particularly around the Beatles split, about how it happened and that it was somewhat inevitable. And I don't really buy that story completely. I think there are certain points at 1969 when an intervention could have perhaps saved things, or a better manager perhaps could have saved things.
I think that's right. I think that narrative is really dictated by the Let It Be film.
Yes.
So that really, the focus of that film was the discontent, the sort of animosity that was building. There's that sort of famous row caught on camera between Paul and George. But it always seemed to me, every time I see that film, I'm surprised at the bad reputation it has. It seems to me it's much less depressing than even I remember from the first time seeing it when it was on broadcast on the BBC.
Yes. It even physically looks depressing, the way it's 16mm blown up to 35mm, and it's just dark and cold and all that kind of stuff.
It's grainy. I don't think it's directed particularly well. I think the editing leaves a lot to be desired. It's not synced up.
Yeah.
The music and so it has a sort of amateurish quality to much of it, particularly the Twickenham sessions. But the narrative, the accepted narrative, is that you know, they came to an end in January 69, those sessions, and then they were all so fed up with each other, they all went their separate ways, and then they convened. You know, we can't leave that as our legacy. We've got to get back together. But that's not what happened at all. They went straight 3 weeks after finishing the Let It Be Get Back sessions. They're back in the studio recording I Want You, She's So Heavy, which appears on Abbey Road. So they just kept working.
I think broadly speaking, we're going to see in the next year or two a total rewriting of the Let It Be / Get Back story when Peter Jackson's Apple-sanctioned edit comes to the fore. It'll look shiny. It'll look clean, it'll look fun.
And they've already started that. You know, he's already said, oh, it's wasn't what I was expecting. Yes. And it was. It
We've
was
already been told the White Album was a lovely, happy.
Yeah, everything was lovely.
Nothing went wrong at all.
No one can really understand why they split up at all.
Yes,
they never split up.
Well, yes, the fact that we're doing this means that, you know, they're just a state of mind, obviously. The birth of I Me Mine, I mean, this is the. I Me Mine is the only Beatles song in the entire catalogue that was recorded in the 70s. So when you listen to all your Beatles songs, you know, it's always amusing that they're so totemic of the 1960s that literally every single song except for I Me Mine was recorded in the 1960s. But the birth of I Me Mine goes back almost exactly a year beforehand to the 8th of January 1969. And obviously the Beatles spent all of January 1969 recording the songs from scratch for Let It Be. And George, kind of in a bit of a, well, his January 1969 was a bit of an emotional roller coaster.
He wasn't in a good frame of mind, and that, I mean, that comes across. And I think I'm right in saying that in the film, he is demoing this song to Ringo, and he's kind of saying, "I don't care if you don't like it. I don't care.
Yeah,
you know, this is something I wrote last night. Like it, don't like it." And it's a very sort of apathetic approach. And this is the song that accompanies John and Yoko.
Waltzing
around.
Which is a lovely moment.
Which is really why I think Michael Lindsay-Hogg, the director, wanted to use that footage, which is then why they had to record. But what doesn't come across in that film is John actually saying, I don't like this song, this band. We don't do Spanish waltzes in this band.
Did he say that explicitly?
Oh, so he absolutely disses the song, and he's not interested.
Yes.
So I actually always assumed that the dancing was a kind of sarcastic commentary on the song, but he really didn't like the song and was very scathing. But that, to be fair,
but Lennon was doing a lot of that in 69. I'm thinking of Teddy Boy when he's do-si-do-ing behind Paul's back and all that. When you kind of look at January 1969, you know, George has just come back from his Woodstock experience. He kind of thinks he's in the band. He's writing. He wants a kind of a rustic feel. I've always thought it was strange that George, you know, Let It Be was trying to get back to something else. So it should have been an avenue for George to do his, you know, Woodstock Dylan band fantasy.
Yep.
And instead he's kind of sabotaging it. Is it because he's not presenting himself well enough? He doesn't do that Paul thing where he goes, here's a song, do-do-do, this is how it goes.
Yeah,
he's a bit more...
I think part of that is that he's coming back into a situation where he is very much the junior partner.
Yeah.
Whereas in Woodstock, he was being treated as an equal by Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
He was probably being treated as more than an equal by the members of the band. You know, suddenly you've got a Beatle, it's, you know, jamming with you. He's straight back into a situation where Lennon is disengaged and McCartney is coming in with that enthusiastic, you know, let's do my songs. And if you listen to some of the outtakes and the bootlegs, you know, you can hear George demoing All Things Must Pass.
Yes.
You know, that's a fantastic song. Yeah. And the rest of the Beatles just completely disinterested. So that had got to the point where by the end of January 69, when they're going up on the roof, George has basically said, condition of doing this, making this film, me pursuing this, coming back into the band is I'm not having any of my songs on this live rooftop concert. Well, you would think, you know, For You Blue.
Yeah, I could have thrown that off in there.
You know, and that's a kind of pretty simple 12-bar blues that they could have written and recorded in their sleep. And I always took that as being a little bit of a kind of accommodation for Lennon. You know, Lennon's complaining, I don't like these songs you're writing, there are all these complicated chords, I can't learn it. So then he comes up with a very basic 12 bar blues and lets Lennon, look, here's a nice shiny lap steel.
Does his little wonky lap steel.
Yeah, play it with your lighter. He's keeping Lennon engaged, entertained.
Yeah.
That song, you could, For You Blue, that could be a band song, that could be a basement tape song. But I think he's just stepping back into the situation where he's very much third wheel.
I mean, you could do a podcast for every day in January 1969, but as we said, you know, I Me Mine appears on the 8th of January. It was written the night before. They did about 40 plus run-throughs of it on that day, along with about another 40 odd songs of various hues. And then, apart from John and Yoko waltzing around, it just gets disappeared. It doesn't reappear at any point.
No.
And it is the only thing from Twickenham, indeed, that ends up on the Let It Be album is Queen Says No to Pot Smoking FBI Members, which is the snippet of chat that opens the album. Now, we could kind of walk through 1969, but we should jump forward to August 69. And the 20th of August 1969 is labelled as the last day when John Paul, Ringo, George are in a studio together in Abbey Road with George Martin finishing off.
You said John Paul, Ringo, George.
Yes,
you demoted George to the end.
John Paul, Ringo, George. Well, it flows better. John Paul, George, and Ringo. I don't think so. No, John Paul, Ringo, George.
I see what you're
doing.
Does
it work? Yeah, does it work? Could we move Ringo even up in that list
a little bit?
Could we say Ringo, 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 George?
Yeah.
But that is technically put down as the last day that the four of them are in a recording studio, and they've spent about 7 weeks doing the main glut of work on Abbey Road. And nobody discusses what's going on. Nobody says this is the last day or we're not going to do anything together ever again. But, and there is no plan, as far as we know from that point, that they were ever going to do anything again.
No, I don't think anyone had made a decision. In Anthology, they talk about, we knew this was the end, or we knew this was going to be the last time. But there's no, I don't get a sense that was actually the case. There was no plan to bring things to an end. And, again, the official narrative is they did the Let It Be sessions, the Get Back sessions. They thought, we can't leave it at that, so we have to record one more final album.
Yeah.
But again, I think that's an official line that has developed after the split. I think that's now the official story, but I don't think that's borne out by sort of contemporary interviews
and if you kind of look at then we have 4.5 months from this Abbey Road final session on the 20th of August and this session on the 3rd of January, and there's an awful lot that happens in that period of time. Like Beatle, a month in a Beatles' life is like more than a year in other bands' lives. So 2 days after Abbey Road, they do their last photo session in Titmuss Park, that famous kind of on the cover of the Hey Jude compilation album where they're looking quite tired and weary. And then the following week, Paul becomes a dad, which is something that kind of gets lost in the midst of time.
Yeah.
That I don't know about other people, but, usually people in the month before a kid comes along, they're buying buggies and baby grows, and they're not trying to negotiate, a new album and a new record contract, which they were doing at the time as well. And obviously Mary McCartney, who was born on the 28th of August, is the baby on the jacket in the back of Paul's McCartney album.
McCartney, yeah.
So she's born into all of that. And then so August becomes September, and in September, Abbey Road is announced and Abbey Road is played back to the media, and it's going to be released. And McCartney is hanging around Apple, and he's doing interviews, and he's doing PR, and he's talking up Abbey Road, and trying to get onto this for it. And in the midst of all this, Lennon starts to say explicitly for the first time he wants out. Yeah.
Yes.
What's he getting at, Lennon?
Well, look at where Lennon is at that point. So Yoko is there. He's been pursuing those sort of avant-garde projects with Yoko. There's the various albums that have come out. He's through the White Album and on into the Get Back sessions. He's very much buying into this idea that the art is about the artist. The artist is the art. And this is coming from Yoko, that everything you do in your life, if you're an artist, is worthy of examination. So they have begun documenting every aspect of their life. They're dressing the same. They're doing various projects. You've got The Ballad of John and Yoko as a kind of documentary of where their relationship and their honeymoon and their marriage. So he's becoming very focused on what I think were initially side projects. Are gradually taking up more and more of his time.
Yeah.
And at that stage, I think the drugs are changing as well. And he's starting to dabble in heroin from the Get Back sessions on. And again, that's affecting his songwriting, and there's a sort of realization that you know, he doesn't want to play with these people. He'd rather, he's happier with Yoko. He's recording with other people. He's doing concerts with her.
Well, he makes this ad hoc decision on the 12th of September to play a gig in Toronto on the 13th of September.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is partially where he tells the manager, Alan Klein, for the first time, oh, I'm playing with other people. I'm out of the Beatles. This is done. And Klein is on the verge of signing a very significant renegotiation with EMI of the contract. And he's like, shut up. And Lennon, obviously being a crusader for truth, decides to
shut up.
Yeah. But then a week later, and George had left the Beatles and come back. Ringo had left the Beatles and come back. But then a week later, they all, John, Paul and George, meet at Apple HQ to sign this contract. And almost in the parlance of our times, John is almost gaslighting the other Beatles. You know, he's kind of saying, I want out, but I'm going to sign a contract that says I'm in.
Yeah, so this is the next stage of their sort of contractual relationship with EMI. The Klein, their new manager, is there. He's been negotiating this. As you say, Lennon is just back from playing a very impromptu gig, which turned up in the album Live Piece in Toronto. He's recorded with Eric Clapton. He's got singles coming out by the Plastic Ono Band, and he just suddenly announces, yeah, I want a divorce. And this is really, I think, in response to McCartney pursuing this idea, we should, you know, get in a van, go back, play some clubs, we just turn up unannounced, and yes. We need to kind of get our mojo back playing live. Because I think McCartney has realized that they weren't able to just get in the studio, record an album without overdubs. They'd kind of lost that spark.
Yeah.
You know, their first album, it was recorded in 20 minutes, you know.
yes.
So they were able to just go into the studio and do their live set, because they were road tested. All of these songs were road tested. They couldn't do this anymore.
In various forms, though, they all did a version of Get Back, but just not together. Like, George does his Delaney and Bonnie thing.
Yeah.
John does this gig in Toronto, so he's not adverse to doing spontaneous live events. So there's obviously a lot of deep running personality issues that are not allowing this to play out the way it should. Like, I bet if Lennon had the idea, it would have
been a runner. I think so, because, yeah, the two people who are most against this idea of live shows are John and George. But yet they're the ones that are going off doing this with other people.
Yeah, they're doing live shows. Paul's not doing live shows.
No. But I think this is, again, I think them not wanting, particularly in George's case, not wanting to be the sideman. He's working with people that he regards as his peers, that regard him as he's a Beatle. He's not the third in line or fourth in your categorization. but you know, he's not playing second or third fiddle to anybody when he's on stage, unless he wants to.
So there are a set of pictures that you know, we'll put up on the Twitter of the 20th of September 1969, where John, Paul and George are signing the contract with Alan Klein, and the body language and the facial expressions. They are signing this contract that gives them a huge upping in their royalty rate from EMI and a huge increase in control over, you know, stopping this practice of butchering albums and putting out, you know, different kind of compilations and half records and all the rest, and makes a promise. It kind of, they're already signed up to 76, but it revises that promise up until 1976. And the pictures of that day are just like, Paul looks just so upset and horrible and run out and just
done. But he's still taking the royalties.
Well, yeah, he still is. I think he thinks it's a thread, because he wants the Beatles to keep going, and he doesn't want the Beatles to stop. No?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that's right. And I wonder, is that the point at which he suddenly realizes that Lennon is serious, or does he not? I don't get a sense that he any of them, you know, John has been here before.
Yeah.
You know, he calls a meeting at one point to say, I've just realized I'm Jesus.
Yeah.
And they all kind of go, yeah, great, fine. that's marvelous. Let's move. So you know, he has form.
Yes.
And as you say, Ringo has left and come back. George has left and come back.
But you could argue that Paul knows. Paul is the man who knows John Lennon, you know, better than anyone, through thick and thin, good and bad. And so he must have known that, to hear him say the things he was saying on that day, that, oh, actually, this is a real thing.
But does Paul actually start reacting in that way? Does he start tempering his behavior in that way?
Well, he does, before he heads off to Scotland and disappears, and we'll touch upon that in a second, John does one more thing, I think, that draws a line under the Beatles. The last day of September, he goes into Abbey Road Studio 2, where he spent many days of his life, and he does he records Cold Turkey with Eric Clapton, Klaus Voormann, and Ringo. And it's the first John Lennon solo writing credit. It's his new song off the back of his heroin addiction.
Yeah.
And I know we've talked before about, should that have been a Beatles song, or would it have mattered if it was a Beatles song?
That's the point at which I think it does become clear to McCartney that something has fundamentally shifted.
Yes.
You know, my understanding is that John comes in with Cold Turkey, the song, and says, this is the new Beatles single, this is what I want to record, and that everyone says it's not happening.
Yeah.
They've already earmarked something as the new single. Mm-hmm. This is the song that's George Harrison's first A-side. This is an acknowledgement by the rest of the band, that, you know, particularly Paul and John, your songs are as good as our songs now. You know, they're not going to disrupt that. Harrison's not having it.
Yeah.
McCartney's not going to have a song about heroin withdrawal released under the Beatles name. Ringo, you know, he's going to just go along with whatever's...
And
he turns up for this. So I think that's the point at which Lennon is thinking, okay, well, I've had a great time playing with Clapton and Klaus Voormann and Alan White and Yoko in Toronto. I can do this.
Yeah.
And I think it's the solo writing credit is probably the killer.
Yes. Because Lennon had McCartney. Already put out Give Peace a Chance earlier that year with a Lennon-McCartney credit.
Yeah.
And McCartney...
Nothing to do with that song. So they're still... Each of them is still honouring that convention of Lennon-McCartney.
Although, you had in the start of 69, Mary Hopkins' Goodbye came out with a pure McCartney credit. So McCartney had actually already played that card.
Yeah, this was always the case. They had this agreement right at the beginning that they were going to share the songwriting credits.
So that starts to...
So I think
that's
a split.
Yeah.
Also... despite the subject matter, this is a kind of proper song. Give Peace a Chance chant.
Accidental kind of thing.
No, this isn't a kind of weird avant-garde crazy
it's
album.
Abbey Road, Studio 2, single in the charts.
Yeah, it goes up, I think it hits number 15.
Yeah.
So it's a chart success.
Yeah. And you can tell it's John Lennon. Like you're listening, oh, that's John from the Beatles. You know, if you're listening to the radio in late 69, it's a bit of a kick.
So I think that's the point at which I think McCartney is suddenly thinking, okay. So he's now directly in competition with the Beatles.
You know, the
Two Virgins wedding album, they're not in competition with the White Album or Abbey Road. This is a single which is in competition with something.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's the point at which it is. I would love to hear a version of Cold Turkey by the Beatles.
Well, it would sound very similar because Ringo's drumming. It would just have probably a slightly more ornate doodly-doo bass all over
it. And that's what it needs.
I think so. Call Jeff Lynne.
It's the guitar playing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the single should have been Cold Turkey and Junk.
Oh, yeah. Junk.
Yeah.
Two heroin songs for the price of one.
For the price of one. But I think that's probably the point at which McCartney suddenly realizes this is a serious issue.
So then in October 1969, McCartney goes up. He's got a six-week-old baby. He's been married to Linda for a couple of months. And he goes up famously to his cottage in Scotland. Now, this is something that is written large in the McCartney legend. And he still talks about it today, which I find kind of, I shouldn't laugh. But he sort of says, you know, I went off to Scotland and I was really depressed and I was, you know, couldn't get anything done. And it was Linda who, you know, pulled me through.
It's like he's in the room.
It's incredible. And, you know, when you actually look at the calendar dates, which I was doing for this, you kind of think he was hardly there at all. How did he goes up to Scotland and he's, you know, he paints this legend that he couldn't get anything done. And yet he comes back after about 8 or 9 weeks with an album recorded, a solo album recorded in his back pocket, or the guts of a solo album recorded in his back pocket. And he's doing loads of different things while he's up in Scotland. He's being dead.
Yes.
So the Paul is dead rumour appears.
Yeah.
He's being doorstepped by Life magazine to prove that he's not dead.
Yeah.
He is recording, self-recording his clips for the Something video, which is curious that there's still Beatle business going on while he's on this remote Scottish plane. And somehow he's also going through this depression.
And he's living in a house with No running water, no electricity.
Yeah, generator for electricity. Yeah,
partially roofed.
And a tiny 6 week old baby.
And a 6 week old baby.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's enough there to get you down without splitting
up. If this happened today, social services would be...
they'd be knocking on the door, and the door would fall off its hinges. Yes. And they would just take the baby and go off down the cobble path. Yeah, so it's... And even the song that he... credits to this time, which is Every Night off the McCartney album. He'd written that for the Abbey for the Let It Be sessions.
Yep.
So that wasn't even a true song.
It's all a lie.
It's all his. It's a, well, good old Paul, the best one. He's always about selling the story, selling the legend, the myth. But yeah, there's from early October to mid December, he's up in Scotland, and assumingly he's vaguely not contactable. But yet he's getting all these things done, and he's self-recording this album, and he's keeping it in his back pocket, and he's not really telling anyone.
Although this is the point at which he withdraws from Apple.
Yes.
So up to this point, he's been, you know, one of the prime movers in Apple. You know, they're all doing something. They're all doing bits and pieces. But McCartney's got Mary Hopkin. He's working with James Taylor. He starts to withdraw. So Klein has arrived. By this stage, Klein has started to clear Apple, get rid of the dead wood. McCartney is withdrawing from that. Perhaps one of the most telling things is when the reporters from Life turn up to say, you know,
Are you dead?
Mm-hmm. He chases them off the farm by throwing a bucket of water at them.
Yes.
And then he realizes this is a terrible PR disaster, gets in the Land Rover, drives after them, agrees to give them an interview in exchange for them, you know, scrapping the photographs of him with a bucket of water. And so he goes back into PR mode.
Yeah. That's what we love about him.
Yeah.
He's always on. He's never off.
He's never off.
He's just fantastic. But yeah, he must have known what he was doing. Like, so he fires up a tape recorder in the...
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
First thing he records is Lovely Linda, which is the opening track off his eventual solo album the following year. So he obviously knew that this is for a solo album, because he didn't tell anyone.
No, and he's recording at home. He's not in a studio. But what he's recording are sort of little experimental things. You know, Lovely Linda.
Yeah.
Not really a song. It's kind of just to test the equipment.
But is this not the version, Paul's version of the John and Yoko experimental record?
Exactly. I think this is the point. It is. And he's got little instrumentals, and he's playing, you know, putting water in wine glasses making noises and just vamping over things. And I think this is an album of little snippets. It's experimental in its own way. It's very rudimentary. The songs Every Night isn't recorded until
much
later. He gets into a studio to record that. He records Maybe I'm Amazed. It was the other big song off that album.
Yeah.
By that stage, it starts to change from being a little homemade experimental album that he then thinks, right, I'm going to have to put some proper songs on here.
Yeah, now without getting too listy, the songs he recorded in Scotland were Lovely Linda, That Would Be Something, Valentine's Day, Mama Miss America, and Ooh You, and they are the kind of scrappy ones.
These are the literally just he's messing around in the studio.
Yeah, yeah. But yet the Beatles machine keeps on going in that period. So, you know, John puts out the wedding album, John and Yoko put out the wedding album during that time. And even Ringo starts recording Sentimental Journey in October 1969. So even he's decided to get on the solo project. I've got my own album to do.
And McCartney appears on that. He works with McCartney on that. He's works with George Martin. The idea there is he's recording a collection of standards, and each one is going to be produced by somebody different. And McCartney produces Bye Bye Blackbird. Is that?
Yeah. Or no, or Stardust, was it?
Stardust.
It's the Hoagy Carmichael Stardust. Yeah. But there's still what I find fun about this is there's still a Beatles machinery at work. So there's still a Beatles Christmas single being put together. They're not together on it, but they all have something on it. And as far as I know, Paul's bit was recorded in Scotland and sent down.
And the interesting thing is, for someone who has said, I'm leaving, I want a divorce, that single, that Christmas fan club single, is dominated by John Lennon.
Yeah.
You know, everyone else, little snip, like Harrison, is barely there.
He just says hello or something.
He says hello, happy Christmas. You know, Ringo is promoting Magic Christian, which is the film he's just completed with Peter Sellers.
Yeah.
The bulk of that single is John and Yoko.
Yeah, so putting out a Christmas single like that, okay, you can maybe read between the lines and say, well, they're not getting on. They're not in the same room. But it's not an operation that's ceasing to be or that's shutting down business.
And they're all contributing. So as I say, if Lennon has decided he's left, he's still literally phoning in the contribution to that fan club single.
And it's fun to remember the person putting that together is Kenny Everett.
Yeah.
Which is...
He was the fifth Beatle.
He's potentially a fifth Beatle. We should talk about that sometime. So I've always assumed that, you know, the session that we kind of we're talking about, the roads leading up to this 3rd of January session, I've always assumed that the reason it happened on the 3rd of January was that Paul was just unavailable, or he wasn't able to arrange anything until he came back to London just before Christmas 69. And as soon as he's back in Cavendish Avenue in his house, that they're able to ring him up and find a slot that suits.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the intention was that all four of them would be there, but Lennon declined.
Yes.
And he, at this point, is heading to Denmark.
Right.
Where Yoko's first husband is there with their daughter, and they're going there ostensibly to visit with her daughter, but people who saw them at the time saying this is the point at which they are starting to detox from heroin.
Yes. And it's, you know, something that Ringo has said for years in interviews is that Paul was the driving force to get them into the studio.
Yes.
He'd always be the first Beatle if they'd had a little holiday to ring them up and say, we're back next week, lads, what are we doing? And I've often wondered who made the calls, or who, you know, at what... Obviously, there's cuts of the Let It Be film happening in the background, and so there's this decision that I, Me, Mine needs to exist. Mm. So this probably isn't something that's been led by Paul to any degree. It's a George song that needs to be recorded, and it's Apple that are saying it needs to be done.
I've always assumed it was Michael Lindsay Hogg was saying, right, we've got this clip. This is a nice little piece. We need the song.
Yeah.
So it's maybe for the first time they're being driven by an outside force to get them back into the studio. And it's interesting to speculate, if that hadn't been the case, would they have ever gone back into the studio?
Yeah. So you still have, this is the crux, so you get to the 3rd of January, it's a Saturday, 1970, you know, 3 or 4 days earlier, Lennon has had his own show on ITV about being a man of the decade and all
the
this.
The
man of the decade. And he's kind of at his peak John and Yoko-ness almost, as 1969 turns into 1970. And he's in Denmark, isn't he?
Yeah, so he and Yoko sort of absent themselves for 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
This is the point at which I think they're, although he's written Cold Turkey, and that's come out, and he's singing about coming off heroin.
Yeah.
He's not come off heroin. He maybe tried, but he is in Denmark detoxing at this point. So he's
cutting his hair.
And cutting, they each cut their hair. and then subsequently, I think, donated it to a charity.
Yeah, they probably buried it in the field or whatever they did.
So he's absented himself. It's a George song. He's probably not interested anyway, even if he wasn't on Smack.
Yeah. So you have George, Paul and Ringo, and it's a classic recording session. There's nothing half-assed about it. It's in Abbey Road Studio 2. George Martin is there.
Yep.
And they are recording I, Me, Mine. They are, you know, and it's a slight song, in fairness. It's a 90-second basic song, but they do something like 17 odd takes of I Me Mine. But it's a real, you know, it's still a real session for a real project. Yeah, yeah. And presumably, you know, what I always think is interesting is, you know, that there's part of this split narrative that says, you know, George felt held back and he wanted to do his own thing. But George, out of the four Beatles, had done nothing towards a solo career by this point, particularly. He hadn't, you know, All Things Must Pass, he hadn't even demoed it, he hadn't got it prepped or ready, he had done nothing towards that gap at the end of 69, he'd done nothing towards solo work except the Delaney and Bonnie kind of tour.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's any sense, this is what I'm saying, I don't think there's any sense at this point that collectively or individually they had decided or they realized, yeah, this is it.
Yeah.
We're winding down. I mean, they realized there was obviously animosity. They weren't going to probably work in the same way.
Mm.
But I don't think there was any sense that this was the final.
Yeah. And it is funny. I mean, in modern day times, have you seen that Metallica documentary?
Yes. Yes.
Where they hang out with their psychotherapist and they try and work out their issues. It's an extraordinary. I watch that film every few years and I feel differently about it every time I see it. I used to, first time I saw it, I laughed at them. Then as I got older, I was like, yes, they need the support, and then it's hard being a parent and all this kind of craziness about it. But there's no machinery like that exists at that time for groups like the Beatles.
No, and I think this is one of the things that I think in Anthology that Harrison says, and in subsequent interviews where he's saying, we did not realize how bad John, you know, how badly off the rails he was at that time. We knew he was going through a lot, but he'd been off the rails before.
Yeah,
you know, in Hamburg, in the kind of fat Elvis period that he talked about, the sort of the LSD trips. That this was just John, and this was just another phase that he was going through. You know, McCartney was saying, you know, he knew at the time he was on heroin, but
yeah.
You know, you didn't have, rehab wasn't really a thing, interventions weren't a thing, that if it was happening 20 odd years later, it would have been handled differently.
Yeah, that's the thing, there would have been a way out.
But there just was no precedent for this.
Yeah.
There was no template.
Yeah. And famously, it ended up on Anthology Volume 3, the CDs. George makes this joke press release in the middle of all of this, doesn't he?
Yes, so he's referencing Dave D.
Dave D is no longer with us, but Beaky, Mick and Titch, we're going to keep up the good work that's gone down in Abbey Road number 2.
Number 2. So he's referencing Dave D, Beaky, Mick and Titch.
Yes.
The Legend of Xanadu.
Listen to the podcast, the Dave D podcast? No,
no, I don't.
Yeah, but obviously that's a very knowing kind of, yeah, we're the Beatles, we're here, John isn't here, but we're just going to keep on going, having fun and... You know, it doesn't sound... I don't think a bootleg of the entire session has appeared.
I haven't heard anything other than
But we don't know what the interaction is like with the rest of them during the day, but...
It sounds jokey, it sounds congenial enough. And
yeah.
It's Paul, George and Ringo.
Yeah, and they've recorded as a threesome in various different versions before, you know?
I mean, particularly during Abbey Road, where, you know, John was at one point... There was a car accident, he wasn't present.
Yeah.
He wasn't present, but... also, he's absenting himself from George sessions anyway. But
George is recording The Inner Light in India on his own and bringing it back. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
No, it's a perfectly standard session. And interestingly, those three in a room, John elsewhere, the traditional thought is, well, it was Paul had fallen out with everybody else.
Yes, well, that's it. And Paul is, but this also is Paul, not wanting to let go.
Yeah,
there's a chance to grab the Beatle stick one more time.
Yeah, but are any of them wanting to let go except John?
I don't think so.
At this point?
And the session that day was a 10-hour session, roughly from about 2:30 to 12:15 the following day. They did an instrumental jam after one take. They did a version of Peggy Sue Got Married at one point. And, you know, they recorded a you know, as is their wont, a song in a day, and they got it all done. And then, but that wasn't it. I mean, if that was it, you could kind of think... Fair enough. But then they go back in the next day and they dust off Let It Be, and they put a new, George puts a new solo on, and Paul replaces John's wonky bass, and they're back to, you know, keeping an eye on the prize that there's a Let It Be album that needs to be somehow put together. But obviously no final decision has been made about what form that will take at that time. And I think this is the one thing that's keeping Paul in the group at this point, is that dun dun dun, Phil Spector hasn't appeared on the scene yet.
Yes.
And it's hard to believe when, you know, it's 4 months later, there's a Let It Be album in the shops that Phil Spector has done his thing to, that Phil Spector isn't even in the country until later in January 1970. He hasn't really been
flagged
for any of this work.
No.
Yet.
Although I read there's a book, biography of Alan Klein, which talks about a dinner, I think in November 69, where Klein is having dinner with Harrison and Ringo and Paul, and this is where Spector's name first appears. So on the face of it, McCartney has kind of okayed the involvement of Spector.
Yeah, and I think Spector doesn't land in England until later in January, and he's given some kind of ceremonial role in Apple as well, isn't he?
Yes.
But, you know, standing in Abbey Road that weekend of the 3rd and 4th of January 1970, you know, as far as Paul is concerned, he's playing on songs for a Beatles album. Phil Spector has got nothing to do with that Beatles album. It's still going to be a rough and ready get... It's still...
Yep.
I still don't think they've even nailed down the fact of calling it Let It Be yet.
No, I think it's still being called Get Back at this stage.
That they're still debating that. And the other thing that's going on that weekend for Let It Be is that they're doing instrumental overdubs. So George Martin is scoring stuff, yep. And there's some horns going on to Let It Be, and it's...
Just like the old days.
Yeah, it's just like normal days. But obviously, when they left on Sunday the 4th, there was no plans to... They didn't swap their deets and then decide to get back to each other somewhere down the line.
No.
Which is pretty weird. So then if you see what happened next, you know, the question is, could something have happened or something not have happened at that time that would have kept them going? And I guess it probably would have needed John to say, let's do something.
Let's get back. Yeah, I think so.
And the thing John did next is probably the thing that was the final nail in the coffin, which was recording Instant Karma. So the 27th of January, later that month, he records Instant Karma. Harrison and himself are in Studio 2 Abbey Road recording Instant Karma. And at this point, Phil Spector is there.
He's there. Lennon has just come back, I think the day before.
Yeah.
From Denmark, so it's either the 25th or 26th, he gets back to London from Denmark. 27th, he's in the studio recording Instant Karma. The phrase Instant Karma comes from the second wife of Tony Cox, who was Yoko's first husband, if you're keeping score.
Can we draw? Let me just draw that out on a piece of paper.
She used the phrase Instant Karma, and he took that, like the phrase, and by, you know, within 24 hours, he's in the studio recording the song. Ringo is in America. I think he's in LA at this point, so he's not available.
Okay.
So again, it's tempting to think if Ringo, who'd played on Cold Turkey, if he had been available, would he have called Ringo? But instead he calls Alan White, who had played with him in Toronto the previous year, and George.
Yeah.
Now, if you listen to Instant Karma, can't really hear any guitar on that.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite sure... you know, what contribution George is making to that song, maybe keyboards, I don't know. But tempting to think if Ringo had been there, this could have been three Beatles recording.
I mean, you know, you go on the internet and there's loads of Beatle fans who sort of do this, you know, Beatles 1970 album, 1971 album, that they try and put together all the solo tracks and have these fantasy albums. But, I mean, Instant Karma... really could have been a Beatles song. It's catchy, it's poppy, it's not about Cold Turkey.
No.
It's, you know, it's designed to be a smash hit. And, you know, you played this kind of what could have been type issues. You know, the flip side of this is that, you know, in February, McCartney is under an assumed name and he's recording Maybe I'm Amazed, and he finishes the McCartney album with Man We Were, or was it May? Man We Was Lonely was the last song recorded for that album. And, you know, there's a parallel universe where there's a double A-side Beatles single in May 1970 of Instant Karma and Maybe I'm Amazed, and it's business as usual. And that could have been a something that could have happened.
It could. I think Instant Karma, again, builds on Cold Turkey.
Yeah.
So Cold Turkey is a proper song. It races up the charts. Instant Karma, more so. I think it got the number 3, did it?
Awesome.
In the UK. So again, it's a direct... competitor for the Beatles. I have a feeling the Beatles were at number 1, Instant Karma was at number 3 at one point. It's after that charts that McCartney goes into the studio.
Yes, because Instant Karma comes out super fast. It's
recorded
on the 27th of January and it's released on the 6th of February.
Yeah. And then McCartney sees this and he's suddenly thinking, right, okay, I'm in the studio, I've got Maybe I'm Amazed every night. Would you say that latter song's been kicking around for a while?
Yeah.
He's recording proper songs for the first solo album, and I think that's what is just really driving home to him,
this is over.
Yeah. This is over.
And it's still amazing about how fast things happen in the Beatle world, because Spector only starts work on Let It Be in March. On the 23rd of March, he does 10 sessions in 2 weeks and he's done.
Yeah.
And then the final nail in the coffin is the Ringo knocking on Paul's door. For those who don't know the story, how would you describe it?
Well, there was a sort of a glut of Apple related product coming out in that month. So you had McCartney had, I think, without reference to the others. So he's recorded this album sort of secretly. He's using an assumed name for studio time. He has slotted this in to the Apple release roster. You've got Let It Be coming out, the Beatles album coming out. You've got Ringo's solo album coming out, and they're all coming out in a kind of 2-3 week.
And Paul never seems to have told the other Beatles directly about his solo album. He told Neil Aspinall in Apple Records, and they told he was tasked with telling the others.
So it just suddenly appears on the schedule. So suddenly there's this glut of product, and the other three and Klein take the view, well, these albums are all going to cut across each other. They're all going to impact on the sales. We need to space this out. They wanted him, McCartney. They decided we need to push this back to June.
Yeah.
There was a Capitol Records convention scheduled for June in America, and they were thinking, right, okay, if we push it back to then, you'll get a bounce off that. You'll be able to release it at the same time. So they write him a letter, and it's quite a nice letter. You know, we've been thinking about this. We're very sorry, but we think it would be better if your record is pushed back to June. Clearly, Paul, at this stage, he's had his run-ins with John. He's had a run-in with George. So the other two send Ringo to be the emissary and to deliver the letter. So Ringo drives around to Cavendish Avenue and goes in and delivers the letter to Paul saying, you know, sorry, have to push your record back by a couple of months for the release date.
And Paul doesn't take it well.
Doesn't take it well.
To put it mildly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ringo was dismayed. This comes out in a court, an affidavit that Ringo files in court at a later point. And I think that's the phrase he used. I was dismayed by Paul's reaction. So I'm guessing there's a lawyer involved in drafting that. But essentially, the story is that Paul almost physically throws him out of the house, and that's it.
Yeah.
Massive rye. And that, I think, is the final.
Yeah, and the end result is that McCartney's date stays the date it is, and I think
Ringo moves his date.
Yeah, and so the McCartney album comes out on April the 17th, and a week before, McCartney puts out this press release that more or less says the Beatles are done, finished, that he's not going to work with John Lennon anymore, and it's interpreted by the press as the date when it's reported Paul's left the Beatles.
It is, and it's an odd interpretation if you look at the questions and look at the background to that. So Peter Brown, who worked for Apple, had sort of said to Paul, you're going to have to do some press, publicize this record. McCartney's not up for that, and he said, you know, you take care of it. So Peter Brown comes up with a list of questions, and McCartney gives the answers to that, and this goes out at the same time as the media advance copies of the record. He never actually says the Beatles are over. He said, do you have any plans to record with the Beatles again, at the moment? No.
Yeah.
Then they never planned anything. Since Epstein's death, it was all very much sort of ad hoc. As you say, Paul would pick up the phone and say, let's get in the studio. So they weren't mapping out, 6 months in advance. They didn't have a strategy. He says, do you see a time when the Lennon-McCartney songwriting partnership would be restored? He says, no.
Yeah.
But again, they've been writing on their own for quite a while. So at no point does he actually say, the Beatles are over, or I've left the Beatles, or I quit the Beatles.
But he knew what he was doing. The context is everything.
He did. But if you go back to that October-November Life magazine story, that's the point at which he uses the phrase, the Beatle thing is over.
Yes, yeah.
But that wasn't picked up.
Yeah.
That was just a story about, is Paul dead? Well, no, he's actually still alive. But he actually uses the phrase, the Beatle thing is over.
Yeah, he does.
But it's in April 1970 that suddenly this becomes the headline. Paul quits Beatles is like it was the Mail or the Standard, and that's the big front page.
But I wonder, was there an impression at the time that, you know, oh well, John's a bit flighty, and of course he's going to put out solo records, but Paul's the sensible one, and if he's putting out a solo record, then it really must be over.
I don't know. I mean, I think it all seems, again, the official narrative seems to be it's all hinging on that press release.
Yeah. And it's, so, I mean, that is the thing. Going back to this 3rd of January session, there's 3 months between that session as the Beatles recording a song for the Beatles, and 3 months later, Ringo's been kicked off the doorstep, and 10 days later, Paul's like, This is done. We are through.
Yeah.
It moves pretty fast.
It was pretty quick. The day that story broke, there were only two Beatles available. Mm-hmm. So George and Ringo are in Apple headquarters.
Yeah.
And there's footage, news footage of Ringo kind of leaving the building.
Yeah.
George is the one who is there front and center and being asked for a quote. Paul quit the Beatles. And he doesn't confirm or deny it. He makes some comment about, well, I think the Beatles would be very selfish of the Beatles to split up. I'm not sure if it's at this occasion where he makes a reference to, you know, a flower is a beautiful thing but a garden is an even more beautiful thing, and I'm sure we'll work together. And so he's very much, he's not saying we, you know, it's all over, we've come to the end of the road. So it's only after that that Derek Taylor then puts out the statement,
which says something very flowery about the Beatles will continue.
The Beatles will continue on in all of our hearts, and Paul is kind of, you know, doing his own thing.
Yeah.
But George isn't saying that.
Yeah.
So even then, you know, George having left the Beatles in inverted commas a year before, he's not the one that's going to say, yeah, it's all over.
Yeah. So, I mean, none of it is neat and easy. And, you know, there's a lot of the Beatles story that is compelling, but they're split. I don't think it was ever really a given. And there probably was stuff that could have been salvaged in early January. But it was just nobody bothered, nobody tended to the garden, really.
That's nicely put. I think they didn't work on themselves.
No.
Yeah. Oh, well. But, I think it is the case that, it's very easy to see a situation where the Beatles continued as a sort of an entity. Mm. They were all doing their own things. You know, the Beatles were never going to record a version of Stardust. So Ringo could go off and do his own thing, do his country album, his album of standards. George could do his Indian stuff if he wanted. McCartney could do his little experimental album. John could put out the stuff with Yoko, and they might come back together again once a year. And you know, they each get, you know, 3-4 tracks. Ringo gets a track, they put something out, and then they go off and do something else. So I mean, George had been working collaboratively with other people. You know, John had been doing that. I suppose even McCartney, to an extent, in terms of his production with Mary Hopkin and producing artists for Apple. So you could see a situation where there was a Beatles album every year or every other year, and actually by today's standards that would be quite a prolific output. In the 60s it was required that they put out two albums a year and a couple of singles. It's
what could have been
a missed opportunity.
What could have been. Okay, well, look, see what you think. Could something have happened on that weekend, on the 3rd and 4th of January 1970. We can discuss this, I suppose, through social media channels. The show has a presence on Twitter. We're at Beatles Pod if you want to get in touch with us there. But I think we've said all that needs to be said. For Nothing Is Real, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we'll see you next time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.